Welcome to When Blue Turns Black, a rare and fascinating exploration of true crime. Join former police officer Vonnie T as she reveals intimate details of her career, explores the psychological toll crime can have with others, and shares her own experience with PTSD.
Just a warning, the content contained within these episodes may be distressing to some listeners. If you or someone you know needs additional support, Lifeline is there to help on 13 11 14. I just want to say before I start this episode that this one's a bit of a heavy one. It's a hard one for me to talk about, but it's the truth and it's honest, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast series in the first place. I want to highlight how the stress and the pressure got to me, and without any support or any help, it led to a suicide attempt. I just want to talk about how I was feeling at that time and what was going on for me, so that maybe you can understand what someone else is going through, or if you are in this situation or feel like the stress and the pressure is starting to get to you, and before it gets to this stage, if I can encourage you to seek help and, you know that that help is it's a long road, but you will get there in the end. It's just that you need a bit of help, and that it's okay. It's okay. So leading on from last week's episode, I was talking about a time when the pressure and the stress was starting to get too much. So before I went off work, I also seemed to be getting a large volume of jobs from other women who were in either domestic relationships, like domestic violent relationships, or they'd had a marriage breakdown or a relationship breakdown, and there were children involved, and their ex-partner had become quite nasty and controlling and vindictive. I had several of these jobs, and just prior to me having that week down at the Gold Coast and coming back, and I think I only lasted another couple of weeks and then that was it. I couldn't turn up to work anymore. But I do recall a job that I went to, which really I knew I was struggling at that point in time. I didn't even tell my partner about this. I didn't tell anyone about it. So what had happened was she was an acquaintance, her daughter and my daughter went to kindy together. She was struggling a lot. She was actually suicidal. Her parents, she was living back at home with her parents. They had contacted me and said that she pretty much won't get out of bed. They're struggling to get her to engage with themselves and with her children. And they just said, look, we know you. We know you from kindy. We also know you from work. Could you please come around and have a talk to her? So I went round and was having, got her out of bed, was sitting there having a cup of tea with her and her mum. And she just felt like the world had got too much for her. Her ex-partner was very controlling. Financially, he had ruined her, and he was making it very hard for her. He wasn't helping out with the children. She was only just blessed that her parents lived in town as well, and they were helping out. She was struggling. She had no motivation to live. I saw in her everything that I had been feeling up until that point. When the stress and the pressure gets too much, and then the depression sinks in as well, it's weird how that works. You're anxious, you've got this anxious energy and this ball in your throat, and you can't talk and you're on this high alert, but at the same token, you're so sad, you're so depressed. And I saw it in her. It was like looking in a mirror. And here I am talking through solutions and strategies for her about the kids and visitation with the kids and, by law, what she can and can't do, and what I've seen in the past with, so many years of policing, and some recommendations for maybe her and him to try and, you know, work things out for the sake of the kids, not work out to get back together, but to work some sort of, come to some sort of an agreement, even by with the parents being involved, or, you know, financially, what some options were for her. I just went through all of these things. And then suddenly I looked at her and, like I said, I felt like I was looking in a mirror, and I felt like physically, I felt like there was like water lapping up at my chin, that I was just about to go under. And here she was crying, and I hugged her. And then, you know, I held on this brave face while I was there, and I left. And obviously I had a bit more to do with them as the weeks went on. I knew that I would go back there, that there'd be more jobs going on between us, because she was really not in a good state. And, you know, I personally would ring her family and her, you know, every couple of days to make sure she was all right. But I sat in the car, in the police car. I had to go back to the station, but I sat in that car and I realized that that was me. That girl that was in there was me, and I was only just holding it together. I was like, oh, like the tears just flowed. I knew that, like I said, that feeling of drowning, that I've been keeping the water at bay for so long, but it's at my chin now. It's just about to take me over. I'm just about to go under. And, you know, my idea at that point in time was just to stay strong, keep doing what you're doing, and just push through it. You know, I brushed away the tears. I went back to the station. I did my job log on what had happened, and I just tried to put on a brave face. You know, I wasn't going to let the boys see that I'd been crying. But anyway, you know, then I went to the Gold Coast, as I explained in that in the last episode, and then things just went bad from there for me. So, you know, I've been getting more and more of these jobs. I just felt like the pressure to help people was just getting so much. There was quite a few Indigenous girls, because we had, you know, there's a large Indigenous community in Gundawindi, and I'm Indigenous myself. My mother is, I was adopted, and I've since found my natural family, and my mother is Aboriginal, and all my family are Aboriginal. Explains why I could run so fast. No, but anyway, I empathize a lot with Aboriginal people, and I always, like, I understood that there was differences with police and why a lot of Aboriginal people don't trust police, and I totally get that. So I tried to do my hardest to break down some of those barriers so that I could be that person that, you know what, mate, if you're in trouble, you're in trouble. It's not because of who you are or the color of your skin or whatever. Sorry, not who you are. It is because of who you are. It's not because of the color of your skin. It's because you've done something wrong, and I will treat anyone, you know, the same. And I tried really hard to keep a really good working relationship, and let them know, let anyone from any Indigenous family know that I'm here to support them as well. You know, you can come to police and you can ask for help. But unfortunately, I started to get more and more of these jobs coming in from other women, especially of an Indigenous background, who I didn't feel like I could turn them away, because I'd worked really hard to foster this relationship with them. But, you know, personally, I'm sinking. And then I've got all these other women coming to me asking me for help in their own situations. And I'm feeling obligated not just to help them, but to do the right thing and check in on them. And, you know, and somewhere in there, it started to eat me up, because there was no one checking on me. I wasn't talking about it. So here I was being this person that people could come to for help, but yet, you know, I was completely dying on the inside. So after several of these jobs, and, you know, especially that job that I just outlined, you know, it got too much. So I presented for work one day, was not well. I couldn't even talk. I remember this, I used to do this stupid burping thing. I say it's like a horse, or, you know, those, when the horses, like the race horses, do that wind sucking where they put their, I don't know if you've heard about it before. My friend, we were kids, she had an ex-race horse, and it used to do it. So, excuse me. In fact, I've got it back at the moment. This is my PTSD legacy. As soon as I get a bit emotional, my little apple in my throat comes back and I get the burping. So it's just like I have to burp to relieve the pressure. The pressure just, it, physically hurts in my throat so much that I have to burp to relieve the pressure, and I will burp all day long. So this is how I was. I was like that. I was crying. I remember I would push through the day and I would get my daughter off to sleep. And, you know, at this point in time, I think when she would go to sleep, she would always sneak into bed with me later on. I've just skipped a little bit. I have to clarify that I finished at work. Like I said, I presented at work one day and I physically couldn't function. I was exhausted, couldn't eat, couldn't breathe, pretty much couldn't talk, pretty useless in my role of policing. Can't go to a job and can't talk to people because you're constantly burping. And I felt like I was physically in pain. I couldn't concentrate on anything. So I went to the doctor and he said, "You've got stress. You're like really highly stressed." And he said, "You need some time off. You need to stay away from work." So I had a month off. In that time, it gave me some time to think about, you know, getting like having a break from work, but nothing was working. I was still displaying all of these symptoms and feeling these ways. In fact, the depression got worse. I'd get my daughter to bed at night and then she would sneak into bed with me later on and I would wait until she was back to sleep. And I remember I would listen to that song by Sia, Chandelier, and I would just cry. I would cry for hours because I couldn't sleep. And all I could do was cry because I was just so sad. And I felt like I couldn't cry during the day because I couldn't let her see that her mother wasn't okay, because her mother was her only constant in her life. And I felt like I was putting on this really good, big, brave front. And then one day she said to me before she went to bed, she said to me, you know, meanwhile, she's 4 years old. She says to me, "Mummy, are you going to cry again tonight?" And I didn't realize that she knew I was crying so much. But, you know, then I thought, I've got to stop this, but I can't. I was at this point where I couldn't see what was going to happen for the rest of that day. I couldn't get through to tomorrow. You know, once upon a time, I would plan, you know, like anyone, plan months and ahead. I couldn't see months ahead. I couldn't see tomorrow. I could only just see today and as it was going. I didn't have any coping mechanisms to get through the day. So the energy would just build up and build up. And then I knew that by nighttime, I would have to go back into that bed, into that dark room. You know, I've been having nightmares before this. I forgot to say about these. There was a job that I attended, the first fatal accident I went to, and there was a female stuck in a car and she died because a gravel truck rolled on the car and she was covered in gravel and she asphyxiated. At this point in time, I was having dreams where I would see her and I could see her figure, like see her outline, see her still in that car, and then her head would just suddenly like light up and her head would move and her eyes were open and she would look at me and then I would wake up. Like it was frightening. And to be honest, I had the same dreams with Alexis. I dreamt that I walked upon her and I saw her there and she was lifeless. And then next minute, like some weird horror movie, her head tilted and her eyes open and she just looked at me. And again, I would wake up and I would be sweating. And, you know, the only little bit of sleep at night I was getting these freaking horrific dreams. So I'd put off going to bed. I'd stay up till 1 o'clock in the morning because I didn't want to face that. I didn't want to have another dream. I was just exhausted. I didn't know what to do. So that's how that feeling just, you know, it compounded. And even though I was off work, it was getting worse and worse and worse. Now that I know about post-traumatic stress disorder, that's just the symptoms. Unfortunately, I didn't get help at this point in time. So I decided one day that I'd had enough. I couldn't feel like this anymore. I just wanted my brain to stop for 1 second. It wouldn't stop. I'll go back one step. I tried medications from the doctors. We were still trialing them. Some of the medications made me feel like antidepressants. They made me feel so sick. I felt every single symptom. Plus, they would make me sleep. And you would probably turn around and say, well, good on you, mate. You could get some sleep. No, when I say sleep, I mean sleep all day and sleep all night. And you can't be a parent to a three-year-old child and sleep. And I had no one to help me, no support. So no family to come down and take the slack and, you know, take her to school or to kindy for me or do any of that. So I had to go back to the doctor and say, I can't be on that. I can't function. I'm a parent. I'm a single parent at this point in time. And I can't do that. So, you know, again, there's that double-edged sword. You need help. But some of the help either makes you feel more suicidal or adds to the problems, you know? And I wasn't in a position to be able to just take time off life for myself. So I was getting to the point where I was crying myself to sleep at night. I was maybe getting 1 or 2 hours sleep. I just got in this really bad pattern and this really bad routine that that's how my life was. I accepted that that's what it was. And I just figured that everyone else went through this the same as me, that other parents, other people who are under stress and pressure. But anyway, so after quite a few months, it just got too much and I just wanted some relief. I made up my mind that my daughter was better off without me at this point in time because I was a complete mess and a complete waste of time. I was living in the dark. I was this dark person who just didn't feel like I could get out. I couldn't get out of it. I didn't know how to. I was sinking deeper and deeper. And so I decided that she would be better off without me and this would give her dad a reason to be there. You know, I'm not saying he didn't have reasons for her. He just was busy working. You know, I don't know. I don't really think I factored anyone else into it. I tried to factor her into it except I just didn't want her to see me like this. I didn't want this to be her life for the rest of her life, you know? So I'd convinced myself she was better off without me, that I'd already made, you know, I'd already spoken to my family members and you know, I had discussed with them if something ever happened to me, because I'd had to, being on my own, that if something had happened, would they take her? And, you know, all of that had been agreed upon and all that sort of thing. So I thought she's better off with them because they're a happy, loving family. They can give her everything she needs. That I wasn't capable of giving her. And I sort of thought, you know, there'll be a payout that will sort out her life, that, you know, she'll have a trust fund there to deal with my superannuation and that sort of stuff. So she'll be looked after because I'm not being much of a parent right now. I'm not being much of anything. So one night I decided enough is enough. I'm not doing any more of these nightmares. I'm not doing any more of this hell. It's done. So I thought to myself, what's the best way that I can do it? So in my mind, I decided to end everything. I had this wonderful plan in my head. I thought, excuse me, that's the throat going. I thought, I'll wait until the timing's right. I'll just hold on. And I'd already worked out that my daughter was going to be away for a weekend with her dad. So she would be safe. She'd be with him. Life would go on. And I thought weekends are perfect. What I was going to do was I was going to go into the police station. Even though I hadn't been there in ages, you know, it's still my workplace. I was going to go in. I was going to make sure it was a weekend when there was no one working or the person, you know, minimal staff working and that they'd be out. And I was going to go and get my gun. And I was just going to end it because, you know, I knew other coppers that had done that. At least, you know, I wasn't trying to copy or anything. I just thought that would be the most effective way to do it. I wasn't thinking what I would be doing to any officer that was working that day. I just wanted it all to end. I didn't actually want to die.
I just wanted to stop feeling the way I was feeling, and I couldn't control it, and nothing was happening, and I couldn't see any end in sight. So the weekend came. I planned it. I went and parked out the front of the police station. Every time a car came past, I went to stop, and I thought, oh, they're going to come into the station. I'd get my phone, and I would I'd look on my phone as if, you know, no one would think that that's anything different. I made sure that there was no one in the station. I've made up my mind, all right? So go in, get my gun out, and I was just going to do it then and there. I worked the guts up, the whole thing. I went to go and do it, and I couldn't remember the gun safe code. And I thought, oh, for fuck's sake. Sat back in the car. I was like, all right, sometimes when you think about these things, you know, too hard, try to remember something, you can't think of it. So just give yourself 5 minutes and you'll remember. Now, you might think this is weird, but I was actually one of the ones at the station who would open the gun safe for everyone. I was really good at it, had it down pat, knew it. I even knew when I was sitting there how the gun safe code had been worked out. I knew the background to it, so I knew that I should know it. But I sat in that car for half an hour and I couldn't think of it. Nothing. I was getting really angry with myself by this point in time because I thought, this was my plan. This is what I was going to do. And today's the day and everything's all worked out and my daughter's safe and it has to be today because I can't keep doing this. But anyway, that code never came to me. So it never happened. I never did it. Obviously, I'm here right now. And I just decided that, well, I'm going to have to find something else to do. So instead, I drove out of town. I drove my car like a fucking maniac. I drove it so fast, hoping that the car would roll, and it didn't roll. So then I was looking for a tree to drive into. I couldn't find a tree. I was driving so fast and so erratically. And then something just made me stop. I just stopped and I just screamed. And I was like, oh my God, I can't do anything right. I can't even do this. But it was at that moment that I realized that this isn't the way out. This isn't what's meant to be for me. You know, someone upstairs is looking after, or the man upstairs is looking after me right now. I don't think so, but this is not my answer, and this is not the answer for anyone else. I was just going to have to find a way to cope because I can't remember my gun safe code. I can't get in and do that. That was the most sure way for me to do it. I can't even drive my car so erratically that I'm going to, you know, I need a tissue. That I'm going to run it off the road. I can't do any of that. Like, bloody hell, how bloody useless. The thing that stopped me was I thought this car's worth something and it might be one of the only things that I've got left that is worth any money that could go to my daughter. And why am I wrecking it? So why am I just going to smash it up, you know, on purpose and lose all that money? Isn't that ridiculous? That's the thing that stops me. So at this point in time, I said to myself, all right, it's not lining up. You're just going to have to find a way to get through this. I don't know how that is, but you're going to have to just deal with this shit that you're going through, deal with these feelings. You're just going to have to keep on doing. You're going to have to ask for more help because you're quite clearly not meant to end your life right now. You know, before this happened to me, I would go to jobs where I would help people who were feeling suicidal. I would talk them down so that I could get them to medical help. And, you know, sometimes I think I was definitely very judgmental. Like, how could they feel like that? You know, life's so good. Why would they feel like that? But I didn't understand that connection of the feelings and those, not just the emotions that are going through you, but that anxious, those thoughts running through your head, those negative thoughts, all the nightmares and all the pressure, you know, and everyday life, the pressure that you already have as well, that you just want 5 minutes of not feeling it. And it wasn't until then that I understood that. And I had hoped that I had been a bit more compassionate with people that I had dealt with, you know, in my role as a police officer. But yeah, that's about as much as I want to say on that. Again, I just hope that if you're feeling not well, or you know someone who isn't feeling well or displaying any of these symptoms, or you think they're a bit withdrawn, please keep talking to them. Please get them to get some medical help and support them in the best way you can. You know, it's not all about just getting medical help. It's a long road to recovery and some support, you know. One thing I want to say about all of this is that I'm definitely not a victim. I don't know that I ever felt like a victim, but I'm hoping I don't come across as being a victim either. Everything I've learned from this whole experience has made me a much stronger person. I am the person I was meant to be now, and I can't say that I'm glad I went through some of these things, but I'm glad I got through them. And so, you know, be that support person for someone else. Don't allow them to feel sorry for themselves and give in to being a victim, but support them. Support them to keep moving forward, the smallest little steps. Get them, like, support them to keep going to their medical help and to keep on keeping on, because it will get better. It just takes time.
Thank you for listening to When Blue Turns Black. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review, which helps others find the podcast, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on Vonnie and her journey, visit VonnieT-TheResilientWoman.com.